Melanie Camillic, who is a professor at UC Davis. She's very well known for using SVMs and other methods for the document classification. And today we will talk about kernel algorithms for document space.
Thank you. Thanks for inviting me, and I really wasn't joking. I really like it. It's a lively, interactive experience. And I haven't seen this for a while, actually. And I like it, right? So it should be like this. If it's a workshop, it should be a workshop, not a serious conference. Oh, let me take away this. It happened before that I have Skype. Thanks. So, I've done this before. So, I wasn't sure about, still I am not sure about the audience, because I just came this morning, unfortunately, and I only caught a couple of, one presentation and a half, actually.
So, but you already know who the crazy people in the audience
are. That's, you know, I have a limited sample size, but yet I made outside the generalization. No, but yeah, no, some surprises are possible, but usually I try to, I don't know, avoid repetitions, and I'll try to not say something obvious. But I don't know what is being said, so please, if you see something obvious or obviously wrong, I know it's difficult, but tell me.
Okay.
So, because I really don't know. So at some point I define latent semantic indexing. I'm sure that everybody will have already seen this here. So anyway, how many of you have used or have not, how many of you know about kernel methods in machine learning? All right, which is not the same as kernel methods in statistics, right? So, okay, so 50%. So statisticians usually start like this, yeah? And then there's glory. Kernel methods, it's related to the statistical topic, but it's a different thing. It's a class of methods in machine learning that appeared in the mid to late 90s in the machine learning community, value machine learning communities. And it has gradually become, in some applications, the mainstream state-of-the-art way of doing things. Not in all of them, but in many things. And you regard these things as part both of the classical subsymbolic neural network type of machine learning, but you see them always at ICML. I've been in the project committee of, you know, ICML called the NIPS for the last few years, nearly every year, and a large fraction, major fraction of the figures, 30% at some point, 35% of submissions are kernel method submissions. And this is a field that didn't exist in 1994. So it has been a nice, interesting ride for all of us who happened to be doing that earlier, very early. In the very first workshops, we were, you know, much smaller than this, 10, 12 people, and students mostly. And now we don't know anything. So you go on databases like PubMed, you type super vector machine, you get thousands of articles written by medical people, I don't know. So at some point, in that trajectory, in machine learning, we had this experience of rediscovering work with other people, getting nervous to each other, statisticians, optimization people, everybody saying, we've done this before, this has a name already. This was the classical experience, you know. And it was good, we enjoyed it, and I'm sure that's the way you learn things. One of the things that happened is that one of our colleagues, a student, Thorsten Joachims, tried in the most reckless possible way to just throw a support vector machine at the text categorization problem, and it worked. And it was an interesting experience. We started realizing what was special about it. You know, high dimensional data of some type have some statistical properties that are really nice. So it wasn't long before I started receiving emails of people making startup companies in the Silicon Valley, looking for email filtering, spam filtering, stuff like this, trying to use support vector machines. I know Microsoft developed an email filter very early on using support vector machines, and just different reasons prevented it from being applied. Microsoft was having trouble in those days with Netscape, I think. So still, they are really conscious of filtering stuff. But yeah. Anyway, the thing is that now you, there are a few fields in which kernel methods are used as a state-of-the-art tool. And the field itself has been growing so much that now there is a very large class of methods, all of them with the same theoretical ideas connecting them. So I would like to present you an overview to this set of ideas, how they connect to each other. And then I will give an interpretation. And in terms of text, you will see that most of those principles in terms of text analysis are natural, even trivial in a way. All the fundamental mathematical dynamics between primal and dual representations, that is the core of kernel methods. What makes the optimization convex, what makes the generalization bound function, is this dual and primal. You have it naturally interpreted in terms of document-based and term-based representations. And so maybe you will think these things are even obvious for you. Keep in mind that these things apply to many, many parts of machine learning. So then after I discuss kernels, the primal dual term document dynamics, I will give you some examples of semantically meaningful embeddings. I will discuss if such a thing can even exist. And then I would like to show some fun examples. Some are string matching kernels, so we try to project documents into a space whose dimensions are indexed by substrings, by all possible substrings of a certain length, and see what happens in this space. All possible substrings of 5, 26 to the 5 possible dimensions. We play a bit with this space. What else? Since I added to improvise parts of this, you will see on this slide at some moment some cut and paste work from one of my books and some other presentations. I know it's not a good policy to put entire book pages here, but I don't mean it to read them, okay? I just want it to be there so I can point you to some equation. So don't tell me I can't read entire pages. You shouldn't. And I apologize now, and I will apologize every 5 minutes until the end of the presentation for putting entire book pages there. I always hated that, when other people do it.
Could you do it full screen mode?
Yes, I can do it, of course. So, the idea. Well, first of all, I want to focus on this concept. In machine learning, people get stuck very often on one task, that is predicting the class of input. They call it text, or they call it classification. In text, I think it's called categorization. In statistics, it's called discriminant analysis. They predict a class. And you hear, you know, this is machine learning. This is pattern recognition. It is one of the million and one tasks that you can be interested in. Kernel methods have this big power. They deal with general types of patterns, principal components and clusters and rankings and various types of analysis and classification. And they deal with different types of data, images, sequences, documents, graphs, very natural in dealing with non-vector data. Again, statisticians are under the pressure that the data are vectors coming from a multivariate normal distribution. And when they feel real adventures, they hazard, maybe there is a mixture of Gaussian distributions there. But that's all they can do. And data are not like this. If you look at data, they look like documents, DNA sequences, and graphs. So kernel methods, I think, part of their success depends on the fact that they can deal with this kind of data naturally. The other part is that most algorithms, all of them you will see today, boil down to convex optimization problems. So if you've done neural networks at some point in your life, you know what I'm talking about. So what is the idea? The idea is simple, it's trivial. You have data, this is not a vector, that is just a set of data points, data object items, and you want to embed your data items in a vector space, in a metric, in a Euclidean metric space, with a map, phi. So every data item x becomes a vector somewhere, phi of x. And there is a Euclidean norm here that you have to define. And we look here for linear relations very often, or relations that can be defined as a function of linear relations. So, and if the mapping function is being chosen suitably, perhaps if you already know the answer, then it's easy. Complex relations can be simplified a lot and easily detected. Why? Because we are really good at detecting linear things. There are 80 years worth of statistics dealing with finding linear relations. We really know the algorithms, we really know the statistics. Machine learning for the last N years have been doing that. So in neural networks, the trouble starts in a network. If you have a perceptron that works, we know everything about the perceptron. We know everything about artificial discriminant, PCA, you know, linear least squares regression. Linear stuff is easy. So how about doing linear stuff in a space where the images or other data are? So that's part of the idea, obviously. not the first time, people always be saying, just do feature extraction, extract a few features, and then do linear things. Second part of the idea is that, another observation, much of the geometry of the data in this space, in the embedding space, is contained in the matrix or in the set of all pairwise inner products. If you know the inner product between all possible, this is vectors, other vector, between all possible pairs of vectors, if you know all of those things, you know a lot of information about them. You don't know exactly everything, you may not know the position. So if you don't have the coordinates of the point here, you only have the inner product. So you can think of a strange rigid rotation around the origin. The set of inner products doesn't change, but you know, in the rigid rotation, the relations between them are preserved. You can find out easily all pairwise distances, all distances from the center of mass, the dimension of the linear manifold on which they lie. You can find a million things just by knowing the matrix of inner products between them. And this is the key. Because that information, in many cases, can be obtained very, very cheaply. So finding the coordinates of a point in that case space can be very expensive. We can have here millions of dimensions. That you don't want to list a million features for every data item. But you may want to operate in that space without knowing the coordinates of everybody. And you can do it as long as you know the inner products between all possible pairs. And this is the key observation of kernel methods. You can get very cheap computation, get the inner product matrix. We call it the kernel matrix. And then you just modify a bunch of algorithms from the shelf, from the toolbox of statistics, from the toolbox of machine learning. Or maybe you make some new algorithms, and you just make sure that they can function only based on this information. If you can do it, you have this key. You can do some sort of keyhole surgery in that space. You don't go in the space. You can't enter there. But you can operate there through this narrow bottleneck, if you want. Everything about your data is in this data structure. Now, instead of putting in a product here, you put it in a product of the images, phi of xi, xy, phi of xi. So these are images. So a lot of research has been done in the first years, in the last 10 years, in transforming everything, every good successful algorithm we like, into a kernel-based algorithm. So you find these papers, kernel least square regression, kernel feature regression, kernel PCI, kernel CCI, kernel Fisher, lots of stuff. At some point, it was clear what are the conditions necessary and sufficient for doing this. And so, maybe I shouldn't have done it, but we made a book in which we stated clearly necessary, sufficient conditions for doing this, and we feel that there is no room for publishing a paper every other day. We do kernel add from kernel, other line, kernel, whatever, because it's clear. So now you see much less of it. Not, it doesn't go through anyway anymore. You don't see this published anymore. They keep on coming. But yes. So we characterize. There's a characterization. Class of algorithms that can be done, can be run, can be performed in a space where you don't know the coordinates of the data. Then the research moved to the second question. Okay, I have 50 algorithms that can work with this matrix, but who gives me this? So research went on to, let's find good, meaningful kernels. The beginning, we had simple polynomial Gaussian functions to compare vectors in some nonlinear space, and you could, I have another presentation I can show you at some point here. So this is the classical picture, We see a very nonlinear separation being transformed into linear separation in a different space. Here you run a classical Fisher or Perceptor algorithm, and the pig image corresponds to that. So you solve the XOR problem and all the classical problems. So the question came how to get kernel functions, how to get the embedding. And a lot of work has been done in that direction too. So now we have kernels that can compare proteins, genes, nodes in a graph by using diffusion kernels. You can compare images in various ways. You can compare text documents too. And text documents, they started being studied by Torsten Joachim's paper. And so his obvious, nice observation was that a kernel is, after all, a measure of distance or a measure of similarity. You can, a kernel is an inner product. If you normalize data, a kernel is a cosine in some space. And we know how to measure cosines between documents if we know information that we have classified work from the 70s. So his idea was, let's make a vector space representation of our data, and then let's compute the inner product between all of them, and then let's run a super vector machine. In this case, he was not taking advantage of the nonlinear mapping, there was nothing of that. Just taking advantage of one special algorithm that emerged in the field, that is called the super vector machine. Super vector machine is a linear classifier that is very good in some conditions to predict binary classification functions. And it's good for some statistical reasons that we not discuss here. But it seems that the text data seem to meet those conditions, and it is why super vector machines generalize very well on text data. So having done that, people started looking at many ways to find more meaningful embeddings of text documents into a vector space, maybe to learn the embedding itself from data. And that is part of the things that we'll show today. Some ways to learn a decent embedding from data. Many of these ways have a name in your community, fully understood by you. So you can talk with me and say, I will acknowledge, I don't claim anything.
Can I ask something about this metrics? Mm-hmm. Does it literally have X 2-1 and X 1-2, or is it just?
It's a symmetric matrix.
Symmetric, yeah. Okay.
It's symmetric and positive definite,
okay.
Meaning all its eigenvalues are non-negative. It turns out it is a necessary and sufficient condition. Any symmetric and positive definite matrix can be regarded as an inner product matrix in some space. So you can give me a function that is a similarity measure between two items. And I say, okay, is this function symmetric? Yes. Is this function positive definite? If it is, I know that there must exist a map phi, I don't know where or how, that send my data in that space where the inner product is this.
Okay.
And that's nice, because then I can just, even ignore the map phi, it has been done a lot. People say, I don't know what is the space I'm working in, but I do know that must exist as a space.
Mm-hmm.
And by specifying the inner product, I specify the metric, all the metric structure of the space. And that's the key observation, because we are going to construct kernels corresponding to embeddings that we hope make more sense. Now, so what tools, you know, efficient discriminant, linear regression. So you can start seeing things like nonlinear PCA, nonlinear least squares regression. Now having a convex algorithm for nonlinear least squares regression or convex algorithm for nonlinear classification was exciting in 1995. It was very exciting because that was when people started really being fed up of that propagation method. And this was a nice timing, I feel. So if one looks back and if one wonders how can a community of 10 people become, I don't know, well, I know for sure that at least 10,000 people bought my book, for example. So you know that. How can this happen in 8 years? Well, you know, sociology, people were tired, people were fed up, things weren't working, this was working. It was just the right timing, probably. And anyway, you have suddenly convex, nonlinear approaches to discriminant regression components and so on. Then, and the possibility of many people to recycle their own work was important. This was a field where everybody could recycle their own work. Optimizers, statisticians, neural networks, text people. It's an incredible community. Anyway, it reminded me today of the things we see, people doing very different topics, trying to talk about the same things. You might find it a bit irritating at some points. I find it exciting. This is what you get when people work on the same things from different perspectives.
This would be a good time to go full screen again.
Yeah. Okay. But this is not meant for you to read.
We're not supposed to read it.
This is the kind of slide.
Smaller.
This is the kind of slide you shouldn't really read. But this is just a list of algorithms. It's a subset of the things that have been canalized. So you can say perceptron, adaptron, partial least squares, PCA, ranking clustering. The small.
Is this the index of your book?
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's not the index. This is the list of algorithms whose pseudocode is in the
okay.
Second book, not the first. You want to memorize this?
No.
You just click here and you get the list for free. Don't memorize it. but you know, these are important things because something like partial least squares means not much here, but it is actually a very important object in some community. People doing chem informatics. There is a company even doing only that. There is a company called Tripos whose money comes 100% nearly for selling an implementation of partial least squares. It is totally unknown statistics. But
what's different in the computation and the algorithm?
Yeah, sometimes you don't want to give an algorithm because we are lazy. So the algorithm is given in a form of an algorithm.
Right.
The computation would just say, find the minimum of this. And that is the solution. We say, this is a computation we can perform. We don't claim it's an algorithm in the link, you know. It's not an algorithm, it's a task.
I see, okay.
But that's, you know, being really pedantic. But we are pedantic, so.
Okay.
So that's the hyperplane in some space. Again, for text, it's not so important to go non-linear, although you can go non-linear. But just to tell you these things, this is a pretty image of a hyperplane in a space. The kernel in this case is a Gaussian. So you take two vectors, same dimension, measure the two norm between them, take the Gaussian, differential, and this is a linear product. You can prove it is a linear product. You do a linear classification between black and white dots, and that's the pre-image of it. Good. Now, why do I say all this? This is the main point of the entire thing. The class of algorithms is very modular. You have many learning algorithms and many kernel functions. Each kernel function produces a kernel matrix. Each kernel matrix can be eaten by a algorithm. So there is this modularity. So you can play Lego. And the resulting patterns you find that are functions of this shape, every function of X is a linear combination of inner products between data points. That's an important thing. So I don't have an example here, but if you want one, I have it in the other. I mean, do you want me to show you what is this and why this it looks like this? Do you care? Or you do? You do. One does. I'll be really quick and painless.
Question? No, I was going to say we could get the
lights.
Yeah,
yeah, right. It would be funny when this goes online.
Just
push
it in.
Push it in.
Thanks.
So I'll just show you briefly one example. So have you seen before in your life the Perceptron algorithm? Be honest. I know it's embarrassing, but okay. We all have. So you have, that's 1957, so we must have. So these are delta two classes in a space. They are linearly separable, meaning there is a separation here. There exists a linear separation. So let's make here a system of coordinates so friendly that actually the linear separation can go to the origin. This simplifies a little bit my equation. So it's one possible hyperplane. Hyperplane can be written, of course, as a linear product between parameter vector and a generic point x. If you have a parameter vector, you can write this as the set of points for which this is true. The points for which this is true live on this side. The points for which this is true live on the other side. Good. So every w gives you a hyperplane. But how can I find a hyperplane, a w, that is guaranteed to correctly separate these two classes always if the separation exists? You have a class of minus one, one. So your data from x1 to xn, data points, nothing to these are stars. These are vectors and they are labeled plus or minus one. So your data of two classes. And then you can say I start with w equal something, maybe all zeros. Look at my annotation. And then I use this temporary solution, time t equals zero, and I test my data. I try to predict the right label to see if it's on the right side. And when I make a mistake, I just add or subtract that vector from the time. So the new w, t plus one, is w t plus or minus x, I, when I made a mistake, times its label I. If I make a mistake classifying a positive point, I will add it. If I make a mistake classifying a negative point, I will subtract it. I add this to the data, and I stop only when everybody is correctly classified for one full iteration. Rosenblatt rules 57, that you can always find a solution if one solution is guaranteed for 50 years. Nobody found the contrary. it's a simple deal. So this is beautiful, it's perceptual, this is the starting point of a lot of things. And why this is interesting? Because it's a simple way to find linear separations. And when you finish, what you have? You have the result in W is a linear combination of data points, just sum and subtract data. And if you never make a mistake here, you never sum this point. If you make a lot of mistakes here, this features a lot of times. So the shape of W is going to be this way. And alpha will reflect the number of times you made an update for that point. Actually, it should even do this. So, to be precise. So this way alpha can be important. Otherwise, it changes sign. W is a linear combination of data points. That's easy. And that tells you something. It tells you that if you want, instead of computing this function to classify a new point, you can use linear algebra and use this function instead to classify a new point, obviously. And that's nice because our data only shows up inside the inner product. And that's nice because if I have another function, k, that gives me the inner product of these people in some case space, I just stick it in here and everything else follows. I don't need to know the coordinates of the data as long as I know the kernel between them. So, it turns out that a lot and a lot of things have this property. The solution of least square segregation, the solution of ridge segregation, the solution of an eigen problem, PCA, all of the solutions have this shape. That means all of them can be written in this way. That means all of them have a dual representation. You can write a dual perceptron algorithm where you only update the alphas. You can write a dual least square segregation, dual PCA, and so on. Everything is dual, meaning everything uses only the kernel in the product matrix. I replace the inner product with a kernel function, positive definite symmetric function, everything can be kernelized.
So before we go any further, I think that in the previous slides you showed us a huge list of algorithms that were kernelized. Do you know if people have been using several kernels? Or it seems to me that, say, you take a Gaussian kernel. You made a decision on the width of this Gaussian, right? And then you run your algorithm. Do you know if people have like implemented a scheme that involves Gaussians of several widths or things like that?
Yeah, obviously, you could do it. So the question he's asking really is, how do you get a good kernel? How do you choose the parameters?
And
of
such
it?
That it depends on the input, right?
Yeah, I know that. There are many ways. it's a bit out of the topic, but I will try to be brief, and then I go back to the text in my name. If you think again in machine learning, neural network type of mindset, you will say, okay, you have a network topology, and I have a kernel function. They both extract some features from my data. Now, you have that pop to train the weight with the median, exponentially median, local minima, and I have a convex problem. Good. Accepted. But they will say, you still have to find a kernel, and a kernel may be an awfully non-convex thing to find, but this is the general belief. It turns out that in many general conditions, you could actually choose a kernel out of a large space of kernels, or a combination of kernels, in a convex way too. And that's somewhat surprising, because it looks very much like a free large. And to some extent, it is, although it's not complete. And so the answer is yes, you can combine together many kernel functions and find the optimal choice of parameters that gives you the optimal solution in some sense, in a convex fashion, by using something called semi-definite programming. I don't know if you're familiar with it. Beautiful piece of optimization. Very nice piece of work. Really elegant kind of stuff. And the way we do it is that we actually don't even try to learn the function, we learn directly the kernel matrix. So we work in the kernel matrix space, it's a cone of semi-definite matrix, we optimize the best one. Now, statistically speaking, and we don't do statistics here, but it turns out that the generalization power of this thing doesn't really depend on the number of dimensions in which you open it. This is the kind of stuff that makes my statistics colleagues cringe, and I'll even split this apart. They learn from kindergarten that the number of dimensions is really the complexity of the problem. If you make dimensions, you must develop the data. The more dimensions, the more let's say a reflex for that. And when I say you have 100 data points, and I send them in a million dimensional space, they will say, you're going to overfit. This is something else, but you're going to overfit. And I don't. When Tolstoy Yakims takes 1,000 documents, and he sends them in a 25,000 dimensional space, and does better than anybody else, they will say, it's impossible, because you must have done something wrong with the consolidation. But it's not true. The problem is, they don't understand statistics. As I said, for statisticians. There is something called the effective dimensionality of the problem, the effective number of degrees of freedom, the true dimensionality of the problem, which is something that really matters. And the theory for it comes from the stochastic processes field. It was developed first in Lubavitch and Chervonenko in the 70s. Now, there is a much different setting for it, the beautiful theory that is called the theory of random market complexity. And it allows you to compute the number of degrees of freedom of a class of functions independently of its dimensionality.
What do you call it?
It turns out that in this framework, the number of mistakes you're going to make in generalization for any distribution, given any distribution of input, so you're sampling vector documents, you're going to learn a function to separate them, and then you're going to test the function on the same distribution. And for any distribution you choose, the number of mistakes you're going to make is upper bounded by a quantity. And this quantity depends on the sample size and on this thing, margin. And you can prove that if your data is friendly enough to have a large margin, you can have very low error rate in generalization for any distribution, and in this bound, the number of dimensions doesn't show up. Why? Because it took the margin really takes the place of the dimensionality. That's very unfortunate to have this bound, because kernels do exactly that. They take your data, they send it in a crazy, sometimes infinite dimensional Hilbert space. So it doesn't matter, because the margin can be coming to your rescue and allow you to generalize well. So the question was then an optimization one. How can we find that the maximum margin, higher than, separated from the rest of the data? Solution, quadratic program. You can always find the maximum margin separating after the rest of the data in a convex way. And you don't pay a cost for the number of dimensions. And this corresponds to nonlinear boundary in the input space. Nearly complete free lunch. Nonlinear separations. I'd say anything because of the notions. So that's a pretty interesting situation. Convex programming, Bose statistics, Bose generalization. This works. Easy to implement and generalize. Now, so super vector machines did just that. Took. So what Tolstoy Yakims did, he exploited this large margin type of approach. He didn't take advantage of the non-linear kernels. He just said, you know, we have enough dimensions already with bigger words. Linear kernels, direct inner product. But let's write everything in a dual way. So instead of using a complete term-by-term matrix, high-dimensional, you can operate on a document-to-document matrix, smaller computationally, run a support vector machine with that kernel matrix, find the maximum margin separating upper end, and use it for classification. And that worked really well. So that's the 2 minute summary. Please.
I'm sorry to interrupt again. It seems to me that the question is really how do you design the kernel so that you have a good knowledge, right?
Yeah.
So are you going to explain to us?
Yes. Yes, I am. It turns out that more study was done, and it turns out the margin is only one of the things you can optimize. There are other things you can optimize. If there are labeling errors, you have somebody here, you don't really want to send to the other side because it's a mistake. You want to have something called a soft margin quantity that somehow tolerates some amount of mistakes. And it has been done, it's still complex. And so on and so forth. And slowly people realize the distribution of margins matters more than the margin and so on. So people got smarter without losing complexity, without losing computational and statistical soundness, we got better and better understanding what makes our data good generalization. And the culture of the community was, let's keep everything mathematically clean. So that was not really part of the framework, that was really a cultural of the group. It was people that tired of the neural networks and all the things. People just started accepting in review, in peer review, only clear theorems. And that created us large group of people. Now we only accept clear theorems and proofs and the clear experiments with a clear, clear. And so I like it, I enjoy it. So it is not exactly the margin, but we do know what helps to generalize, and you can make kernels. So what people realize later on is that you don't want to be, you know, too arrogant. And if people have been working in a field for 20 years, chances are they're not stupid and they know what they're doing. So why should we try to reinvent things? If you want to work on protein data, learn from protein people how to make a good featureized pattern system. If you want to learn with documents, go telephone some information retrieval person and discuss with them about the embedding. And that's what happened. We learned a lot from existing literature how to make good kernels that make good sense. So the TFI, of course, worked. It already existed, the cross line for that. It was used for retrieving. Now you can use it to do PCA or classification or ranking, but it's the same measure. So if LSI existed, why did it go? If LSI existed, let's make a kernel in that space. People have done this for a long time. And, you know, people are clever and we should learn from them. That was the spirit. And it happened a lot in bioinformatics. Lots of kernels came from bioinformatics. And the Hausler's group in Santa Cruz had this amazing HMM to predict the remote homology of proteins. Remote homology, if two proteins come from the same ancestor remotely, it means a very low sequence similarity in the primary sequence, but the fault is still the same. HMM was working pretty good, and then they thought, let's make a kernel out of it. So now you have a space where you can embed your proteins. And the metric in space depends entirely on this HMM. But then you can do things that you couldn't do before, like PCA. So it has been done over and over again. So that's one way to ensure good embeddings. And I think if the embedding is good, a good margin follows. That's the idea. Now, let's show you this. So that's why we have this shape here. That's why the decision function looks like this. So some of the patterns that I like a lot, essentially what we generate is this, you know, the concept that a direction in the bigger world space is actually a concept. That's a nice insight. There is a space, every direction is a term, every axis is a term. Non-axis parallel directions are combinations of terms, concepts in a way. I like it. You can represent these things, you can work with these things, you can discover the best concepts. And if you start with a very high dimensional space, you can project your data down into a subspace and manifold that is spanned by a few interesting concepts. Why not? What is the best choice? That is the kind of question people ask. So from here on, I start cutting and pasting stuff in the book. So apologies, don't read everything. And I will redefine things you've seen probably a million times, so you can tell me to skip. So we have the term frequency, term one on each document. So the document D is represented by the term frequencies of what possible terms in this document, counters. And then a data set, a corpus, can be seen as a document one, document two, and so on. So it's interesting because given this matrix D, we can think of the document-document similarity or the term-term similarity in a fairly symmetric way. And that allows you to play with primal and dual representations, like it happens there. Because, of course, the primal and the dual solution here are very much connected by the data. So you have this connection between the data and you can play. And that's what I can see. So a document is represented by the counts of the terms appearing in it. A term is represented by the counts of the documents in which it appears. And you have this representation. Oh, forget. But no, don't read, but let me tell you one thing. You can already think in terms of slowly improving your kernel and the kernel matrix, and in this way, enhancing your embedding, just by simple manipulations. You want to remove words, you want to emphasize or de-emphasize some words, you multiply your kernel matrix times a diagonal matrix. So everything I will say here is in the term view for simplicity, but everything can be recast in the document view by algebra. So you can have a diagonal matrix that has a weight importance for each term. Some terms count zero, they're stop words. Other terms count more because they have the IEDF and TF score. Make a diagonal matrix, multiply your kernel matrix, has this, get a new one. Maybe you don't do it in this way, but implement. But morally, you are performing a linear operation. You want to normalize the length because the length of a document matters and doesn't affect its topic. Okay, so you really want to divide each vector by its norm, do it. You take a kernel matrix, you make a new kernel matrix, where every entry has been modified by this. Given the kernel matrix in the origin, you have all the information to do this. So you have a new kernel matrix now, this has been normalized and de-emphasized and so on. So you can make a chain of very simple linear things, each of which you can control. Remove stop words, change the weight of the relevance, normalize, then you do some other query expansion, whatever you want. When you finish, you know what you're doing. It's all linear, you can always multiply everything together. You have a semantic proximity matrix that you can use. It's all linear. You can telescope things into one matrix. So this is one of the things people did. Try to learn from data some clever matrices. So this happened still very early on in the 90s, but I like to mention these things as we go so we can catch up. So conclusion, the kernel matrix, the basic one is the data transport. Here it is. Then from here on, we manipulate K and we change the embedding. So think of a semantic proximity between terms. You can just multiply, you can think of two different ways. One is make a big square matrix. We call it Q, I think, in this notation. That is a term by term matrix. And in every entry ij, we write the semantic similarity between I and J terms. Zero if they don't have anything to do with each other, and high if they are connected. So when you multiply your data through this matrix, you get a new representation of the data where you have essentially expanded your query. You created positive entries for terms that were absent from the document, but they're semantically related, so you need a matrix multiplication. And when you compare two things in that space, even if two documents have no intersection, that project in the new space is correlated at the positive score. So you can think of this, and we are going to play with it. So you can think of a semantic matrix made of time relevance and the proximity information multiplied together. We will discuss mostly about the proximity information. The relevance is more of an academic point. Here we go. So think of this. Or think of P also could be a simple term by concept matrix, rectangular. You can have a list of concepts and you can say every term belongs or not to a certain concept or even a software assignment. So every document.
It's inverses.
Pardon?
Transpose.
It's a matter of notation.
Yeah.
So you have a, you can have a, the projection of your document into concept space. This one also. And then you compare them in space. Nothing new for you. This is stuff that you know really well. I just want to combine it. Or you can take these two things together, make Q, and Q is your square thing that gives you the semantic similarity between terms. Good. So now we are fishing for a good Q matrix. Q should be positive definite for us. So it's better to think in terms of P, because then the product of the two is always symmetric positive definite. So we're really looking for a good matrix P. Remark, no idea. Stemming follows this. If you want to stem words, you want to take 10 words, the same stem, different endings. You want to map them with the same stem. You are really projecting. You are really projecting down. So you can make a matrix. You can think of stemming as one of these operations. We don't do it in practice, but it's nice to think of it in this way. Stop word removal, stemming, IDF, TF, normalizations. All this kind of classic pre-processing can be seen as just a series of successive embeddings in a better and better and better space, and making a better and better kind of matrix, and essentially making a different linear map. It's all linear here. We will go on linear before the end, but we do just in the end. How do you make a semantic matrix? Well, one thing people have done is been take a WorldNet, take a semantic network, and just measure how distant the two terms are and make a brute force matrix. I mean, don't do it really. you only feel those entities that you're using. You don't feel them by thing, but morally, you're feeling your smart embedded roadmap. Other people take dictionaries. Other people try to analyze core coherence patterns and infer from data by linear algebra. That's something interesting to me as a machine learning person. Can I learn from data? Can I learn from a corpus? Semantic similarity between terms. So let me skip this. So this is your generalized vector space model. You can decide that two terms are correlated if they co-occur in the same document. So in this case, your matrix B is actually the data matrix B. You just project your document onto the data matrix, and now two documents are similar if they have a similar. You really represent a document now by its distances to all the rest of the corpus. That's the new representation of your document now. It's in a product to all the rest of the corpus. It's a new base. It's not even an orthonormal base. It's just, it's a base. And you can compare here. That's okay. So you can, that's valid. It is valid kernel. Done, of course. Or you can do LSI. Again, I can't teach you LSI, but you do your expansion, your SVD, you get your eigenvectors. Here are the key ideas that the interesting principal components correspond to highly correlated objects, so they are more likely to be co-occurring worlds, and if they're co-occurring, they might be semantically related. And then you can choose a number of dimensions, 5, 10, 20, 100, and you project down. And then doing a product there. And so you can think of this just as ways to build your semantic proximity matrix from data. We've done experiments with all this, and we can always put some advantage in everything, but maybe not as shocking as it would like, but the effects that we can measure. These are relations between the two. I found surprisingly strong opinions about this. I found people really don't like it. I don't know why people really don't like it. So just keep a neutral thing and report the results. That's what I like. I like algebra. So this is something I said. Now, something that I want to discuss a little bit is how much time do I have? Is it 10 minutes or 1 hour? 10 minutes. I wasn't sure. Because this is just the third. There are three more things I want to say, so we'll try to be quick. So you can do cross-language analysis. And, of course. And some people also use LSI for that too. You can just cut it together, the French and the English version of this document, and you perform the semantic indexing, and then you have a kind of common semantic base for both. And so I took a different approach, and I thought of the kernel CCA, first the classical CCA. Are you familiar with the classical canonical correlation analysis tool? No one. One. Yeah, it is pretty much the right proportion of people. I found that we are a very good group. We represent the average of the population. People don't know that the same person who did PCA, Hotelling, and you should explain, by the way, how can you make a PCA in the 30s because there are no computers? How can you get the IBM? He did it. He also did the CCA. CCA is a canonical correlation analysis. And it is an attempt to extend the notion of correlation coefficient to multivariate variables. So you have a random variable here that is not, if they're both real, random variables have a clear correlation coefficient given by the Pearson coefficient, it is also sort of a cosine itself. Now what if this is a vector, and this is also a vector, and maybe even in a different space? Now you're generating vectors here and vectors here in a different space. How do you know if the two things are correlated? You might have to distribute, maybe you expect it to be. One is a vector of clinical measurements in patients, and one is a vector of outcomes of the prognosis or something, and you think there must be some correlation here. You can measure blood pressure in the person with a heart attack. Maybe there is. But they're vectors. How do you correlate vectors? So one master could say, okay, do PCA to both of them, and then you measure the correlation of the first component to the first component and so on. But that's really a cool, simple-minded approach. What you really would like to do is, and it's hopefully this, take the first space and take the second space. Identify pairs of points that are in bijection. You must have bijections, yeah? Now, this is M, R to the N, this is R to the N. And now you say, I will project my data onto direction WX here and direction WY here. And after projecting, for sure the projection is one dimensional, and I can measure the correlation coefficient between projections. That's again PCA, projecting one direction. PCA measures the variance, give me the maximum variance direction, or also the minimum is the square residual. That's PCA, so you end that's an eigenvalue. Where's CCA the same? Find the best choice of concept, topic, in French, in English, in French and in English. I keep on saying English, French, and I get it occasionally. So you have these two spaces, and the projection can have a correlation. Can you maximize the correlation over the choice WX and WY? Can you maximize? You write a little problem, it's an optimization problem. You do some algebra, and you get a generalized eigenproblem. Something looking like your old generalized eigenproblem that you matter between it in a second. Why do we like eigenproblems? Because you can solve them exactly. Finding the first eigenvector is a complex problem. Finding the others isn't, to speak, a convex problem, but you can always deflate your matrix and reduce the second eigenvector to the third eigenvector of the new matrix. So you have an exact solution, cubic time. That's why we like CCA. Exact solution, cubic time. CCA is the same. So you can find directions here that are maximally correlated to directions here. It means, is there a topic, is there a set of terms in the French corpus that is highly correlated to a topic in the English corpus? Topic shows up in the same documents and doesn't show up in the same documents. If you have one such direction, it's your WX, and that is made here. There is no, in a way, unsupervised. Take a Canadian Parliament, and a Canadian Parliament corpus, and you find directions. And then you look at them. I've done this with Canadian Parliament, I've done this with other corpora. Sometimes they make a lot of sense, sometimes not so much sense, because we need to learn how to regularize. High-dimensional spaces and few data points can lead to degenerate solutions. So learning how to regularize this is important. We add some weight decay terms, we add some properties, they all boil down eventually to manipulating the diagonal of the kind of methods. But having this kind of capacity control is important. After that, doing things correctly, we can identify topics. Not only topics that are topics in English and topics in French, they look like each other. Please.
Yeah, so I have a question that is orthogonal to the kind of level. You mentioned cubic time.
Yeah.
For the, you know, if you use the iterative methods, right, you can do it.
Less. Yeah, if you want less directions.
Right, just one.
Yeah, you don't want one.
Well, yeah.
Yeah, okay. If you want one, then it's less. It's
right.
There's the Lanczos method that you
can use. Yeah, it's linear in the number of sparse entries, right, in the matrix.
Right, and it's not so sparse, but it's a block diagonal, so it's kind of sparse. So, what was I saying? It's interesting. So these things, differently from PCA, don't really need to be to be orthogonal. We don't ask for that. They need to be uncorrelated to each other. I'm not talking about that's a detail maybe. So you could even throw away the French part later or the English part and just keep this as a good semantic mapping in the subspace. Or you can keep both languages and use to do cross language retrieval, either way. Or you can do it in three spaces, or in four spaces. You can give me the six language Bible we mentioned before and make six-way CCA. You can just define a correlation between six random variables and then optimize simultaneously all of them, all the six of them, which is very interesting. So this is the definition of correlation coefficient, covariance, covariance. This is your maximization problem for CCA. This is how it looks like before the queue and after the queue. This is an eigen problem. Your matrices are block diagonals with covariance. This is the primal. In the primal CCA, it uses covariances. Everything is in the term representation. So each of them has, you know, 40,000 dimensions, two of them. But once you go dual, equivalent representation, you get a new eigen problem. It is in document representation. This is as large as the corpus now, much smaller possibly, depending on the data. So this is stuff that you can do in MATLAB, and you can get your eigen directions out. So here are a fake representation of 10 documents in some space, English and French. And this is too much. So this is some of the directions we found. I don't know how they were chosen. The student Blas Fortuna here did the experiment in Ljubljana. So some of them are, keep in mind these are parliamentary things in Canada. So you have health minister, Quebec, prime minister, probably, Kiwi, federal hepatitis. You know. And then you have Santé, whether it's health, minister, Quebec, and more. So many of them match, not all, but many of them match. And then you have something about the petitions and languages here, who knows what happens in Quebec, and then here you have motions and bills. And these are pretty similar, but not the same. So you can find somehow something that could be topics. In the other experiment I published at NIPS, it was not this, it was a bit different setting. We had found one topic about pensions in Canada, one about fisheries, one about health. Three, four classical legal topics, very clear. And then a few others that are kind of mixed, which is a bit disappointing. But now we can retrieve, so we can do two experiments. Either mate retrieval, can I retrieve the document that was the mate of this English document? And then the other experiment we can do is classification, text categorization. We just throw away all the data. So we take a corpus, we learn an embedding. And then we throw away the data, we use this map as a kernel for different data. We use the Canadian Parliament to make kernel, and then we use the Reuters data to classify. And even if the topic was different, we got good classification. Then we thought, actually, you know, maybe we are really pushing it because we are in a different topic domain. How can we get similar topics, and how can we save the time of actually finding a bilingual corpus? So Blas Fortuna, the student in Ljubljana, found a clever trick. He got a corpus that only has one language. And then he fed it through Google translations and he made a kind of a low quality translation of everything. And then he proceeded in the same way. And surprise, it works better than using a real hand curated. Because probably it's closer to the topic. We don't have to change the domain, train on Parliament and test on order. We are just training and testing on the same kind of domain. So we can actually make, so that's the good news. You can take a corpus, use the Google API, make a bad French translation of it, do CCA, get a good semantic embedding, throw away the French translation and keep your embedding. It's a semantic embedding. So you can have a Google, some Google in your kernel or something like this. Google inside. And these are experiments that I skipped because I don't like to show tables to people. So you will ask why did I put the two? I don't know. And I will not do the semantic kernels, but they have been done somehow by Stefan, so it's morally, he's done the semantic graph diffusion part. We can do kernels where the idea is this. Okay, two terms are similar if they appear in the same document. Can we say that two terms are similar if they appear in similar documents? Sure, but what are similar documents? Well, similar documents are documents that contain similar terms, and so on. So you want to solve the system all at once. You solve it, and then you get a kernel that is a diffusion kernel. And it looks one of them like this, the other one like an exponential. You just have this kind of, you really don't want to do the entire Markov transition matrix thing explicitly, but you remember that this series can converge, it's called the von Neumann series and so on. So this is at NIPS 2-3 years ago, and I'm sure that you can click here and get it, so you don't have to say it. Because in the last minus 1 minute that we have left, I want to show you string errors. Are you ready for string kernels? Are you have questions about the semantic diffusion, CCA, LSI stuff?
I think we really ought to hold them anyway in the
Exactly. You're hoping. Well, because they talk after me. Yeah. You have a question.
So are you going to skip this non-linear stuff? Or?
Yeah, I just did it.
Ah, okay.
You missed it.
No.
You were only just.
That's what we want.
You all came here to see the diffusion camera.
No.
I can show you. What is your question first?
Oh, I have no question. I'm just waving.
Oh, just waving. I do that sometimes. I do that sometimes. Okay. Let me show the screen camera, and then maybe you go back. When you ask me questions, you ask me to show them. Because I am really proud of this, and not proud so much. I just want to show you because it connects to, you know, to your slide, and I like this slide. So you were showing that you can capture some sort of rough semantical structure of a language, and then you compare them. And by comparing them, you get the tape. And I like that. Although I would, if I had your software, I would do more experiments because there are beautiful phenomena in how the semantics can evolve. You just follow from Latin to Italian, and you see this incredible change in the patterns of association of words. And I want to capture this. One day I will. For now, I just look at lexica. And the lexicon evolves too, of course. And if you do bigger words, you don't care about anything else. Lexicon matters, and construction goes away. Now, I've done a lot of work. I'll show you only one of them. A lot of work means I even built a time series of documents from minus 400 to plus 21st century, every century represented by a few documents. I have a continuous series from the oldest Latin thing I found to today's Italian, French, Spanish, and Portuguese newspapers to study the evolution of statistical properties of the language. What statistics do I care about? Well, let me tell you something Keras can do. You may be interested in mapping your documents in a crazy space in which every dimension is represented by a k tuple, maybe a k gram of letters. K can be 5 or 10 or 10 or 3. And we did this early on, and we tried to do semantic classification with Reuters data, and we succeeded in part. We had probably as good a classification as a bag of words by simply sending everything in a space of 5 grams, every possible 5 gram, and then doing super vector machines there. And we had a kind of dynamic program that a given two sequences would do a very efficient computation and return the inner product in that space. So compute every possible 5 gram in the sequence, so you're morally making a vector of 26 to the 5 dimensions, and then take an inner product. That was slow. Now we learned how to use the suffix trees to do this in a linear time. So in linear time, you can take these documents and analyze all possible k-grams and make it you can do some semantic if k is large enough. Not surprising, because a word is long 5-6 letters, so do bigger words, really. But if you look at pairs or triplets of letters, you capture something more interesting. You capture something about the language itself. It has been known already for a long time that even the frequency of letters is a unique signature of a language. You know that English has its own distribution of letters, different from Italian. It has been less. It was known to Shannon and everybody doing these studies. Less studied was the fact that you can actually notice similarities between Spanish and Italian, for example, in terms of letter distribution. Although you know this, because when I go in the airplane and somebody's speaking Spanish, I always try to, I think they may be Italian automatically. It's something to do with the distribution of sounds. Anyway, you can count the distribution of all the pairs or triplets of letters in a document. So we took the Human Rights Declaration, translated in many languages. We computed all the pairs and triplets and the frequency in each document, and we compared them by inner products. We didn't really do that. We just ran a suffix tree kernel that returned to us the solution of doing an inner product to those vectors without computing those vectors. And then we had a big kernel matrix, a similarity matrix between all languages based on statistical properties of the lexicon. And then so that's what we do. This is a fake data, random data, two Markov processes in this case. That's how they look like after embedding. Different statistical properties lead to different locations in the space. Obvious. 3 grams in this case. Now, do it with a document, and you find a kernel matrix, then you call some bioinformatics software, name or joining, for example, to make a tree. And here we have, you know, Catalan, Asturian, Spanish, French, Galician, Portuguese, Italian, Corsican, Friulan, and Latin. Latin hitting the root of the tree, as you would expect in phylogeny, being the root of the tree. And then here, this incredible tree, Serbian, Bosnian, Croatian, Slovenian, Czech, Polish, all together, the Slavic family, and then Latvian. And we know there is a Balto-Slavic family. And then crazy things here happen because these are not Indo-European. And in fact, Kurdish, Turkish, Uzbek, and I don't know this. So Basque, we used it as an outgroup. The outgroup is important to find the root of the tree, of course. And mistakes too, we find mistakes. English is here. English goes together with Nigerian English and goes somehow next to the Latin, not to the Spanish, thanks to 1066, right? Thanks to the big amount of French lexicon in the English language. We don't do syntax. We do lexicon. That's why you can get English right, we can't. We only do syntax, lexicon. And lexicon in English is French, largely. Danish, Swedish, Norwegian, Icelandic, and so on. So there are mistakes and there are interesting things. The point is, these are semantic. Don't push me away. I've done this. I had a workshop a few months ago, and this guy shows up for a 40-minute seminar with 104 slides. And again, after this time, I did the same thing as you did. And I'm going to leave.
I don't see the Greek here.
Because I was lazy. And it's written in the lovely alphabet. And I didn't want to translate it. But I know where it will go. It will go on its own, like a Greek would go on its own. But because it's true, because it is going on in linguistics, it is one family. It's a linguistic family containing one element, like also Armenian. There are some interesting families of one element. One is Greek. Latin has a family of many people. But it would go on its own. But I know that it will go not far from where it should be, yes. Now, this is a different type of kernel, but same result, okay? So I don't want to make it too big. Here are links for you to play with. If you have any questions, we can discuss them. Otherwise, I apologize for being so long.
Thank you very much.